is John Dewthany, recorded by Chris Alden Lee on the 12th of October 2011. John Dewthany, Part 2.
There was I. This was just after I became base commander. So I was 22, coming up 23. I was incapable of growing a beard. Okay.
I must point out you have a rather luxurious version these days.
Yes, but I wasn't capable of growing one then. And had you seen me, and I could probably demonstrate this by just showing you a photograph, you would have thought I was probably about 17. I was very slight, under, well, around 10 stone in weight. It was my day on Gash. So I was sweeping the corridor in the main hut at Argentine Island when there was this noise outside. And this helicopter lands outside the base, out of which gets a naval gentleman who walks into the station and basically followed by an admiral. Well, he's somebody with a lot of scrambled egg on his hat anyway, who basically asked me, rather imperiously, to take them to my leader. So I try to convince them that I am he. And they really weren't having any of it because they just couldn't conceive this young lad who was dressed in his, you know, rubbishy old clothes and sweeping the corridor could possibly be the base commander.
I presume you had a distinct lack of scrambled egg, did you?
I had no scrambled egg at all on my hat. I didn't actually have a hat on. There might have been some in the gash bucket that I was moving around, but no, I didn't have any scrambled egg. And the only way that I was able to convince them that I really was the base commander was to call those base members who were available together in the lounge and tell them to point to the base commander. And it was that that finally broke the ice, because they were really quite... they thought I was winding them up, I'm sure. And then we had the usual jollity of, you know, a bit of whiskey and a bit of a chatter and that sort of stuff, and they went away happy. But it could have been, you know, quite a diplomatic incident, because I really didn't look like their idea of what a base commander would look like.
Why were they there?
Oh, that was just an official visit in the summer. The Antarctic Treaty allows that sort of thing, but they were just coming in for a social visit, really, to see what we were up to. And to have a chatter, I suppose.
What else from that those 2 years stands out in your diary?
Oh, well, there were several other fascinating incidents. So there was the great freezer disaster. In my first winter, we didn't have a freezer, so we had no fresh meat at all, apart from one piece of beef that we kept in a snow hole for midwinter, and it was fairly reasty by the time we cooked it for midwinter, but it was nice enough. Mm. So fresh meat was a bit hard to come by. In our second winter, we had delivered to us this wonderful freezer in which we could keep lots and lots of fresh meat. Well, midway through the winter, the freezer lost all its coolant gas and failed. Now, although, you know, it's cold in the Antarctic, it's not that cold sometimes to keep meat fresh. So we got this mountain of bloody meat, which we wanted to eat, and not all at once. So we built a freezer.
You built one?
We built a freezer, and we built it out of the following materials. We used to be supplied with the sons for weather balloons in big wooden crates that were called son boxes. And so we took some son boxes, and we made this insulated box. So, you know, an inner box and an outer box, which was about, I suppose, 2 metres by 1 metre and about a metre deep. And now on the station, we had a wind-finding radar Mark II. And this was there to track the weather balloons. But it had a history. And its history was it had come from Christmas Island. And because it had come from Christmas Island, in the back of it was an air conditioning unit that we never used. So we took the air conditioning unit out of that and we fitted it into the end of the box. And then we switched it on and we put the lid on the box. We had it down in the generator shed one Saturday evening. And we put a sonde in it so we could watch what the temperature did while we were having our Saturday dinner. And the temperature went down and went down and went down. And we'd built ourselves a freezer. And that freezer stood on the balcony at Argentine Islands for several years as the sort of kitchen overflow freezer. But for that winter, it saved all our fresh meat. And it was, you know, it's one of these things that FIDs do. FIDs bodges, you know, and it was the thing that you did in those days. Because we it was a very hand-to-mouth existence, really, for Bass in those years. We built a freezer, and it worked. Yeah. And it was just one of those many things that brought the base team together, I think, was and why, when we had the crisis, we were able to deal with it as well as we did.
Before I move on, is there another episode or story from...
Oh, well, there's various stories about sealing.
Go on.
Well, you know that we used to have to hunt about 60 or 70 seals a year to feed our dogs. And when I took over as base commander, the outgoing base commander, Speedy Swift, was an RAF sergeant. And so I thought I should get some firearms training from him, because I had quite an armoury on the station. We had Lee Enfield 303s, which actually dated from the First World War. We had a shotgun, we had a 45 revolver and stuff. So I thought I should get some training in guns. Not the least because we had this rather unfortunate incident where we went out sealing. And we used to do the sealing from a small boat. And I was driving the boat. And I had in the boat with me the diesel mechanic who had a 303. And we'd taken the radio operator out with us, who didn't go out very often. And he was packing the 45, okay? He had got the 45 strapped to his leg. And he didn't like leopard seals. He really didn't like leopard seals. Anyway, out in the channel outs off the station, we came across this leopard seal. And the diesel mechanic fired at the leopard seal. He hit it, but he didn't kill it. And Robin, the radio operator, sort of lost presence of mind. And he whipped out the 45 and opened fire with it, all six shots at this bloody leopard seal, while the boat was drifting. And sadly, we'd drifted so that the other side of the floe on which this leopard seal was sitting was the base. Apparently, they were hiding behind the Argo. A little flag came out, waving to tell us to stop firing. But dogs like very rotten seal meat. And the way that you deal with seal meat in the winter is that you chop it or saw it because it's frozen solid. And it's a base job. And I went out one Saturday with a colleague to do the seal chop. And of course, Saturday's a big night. You're going to get dressed up and everything. So we were chopping away and bits of seal flying around like shards of wood and stuff, splinters of wood all over the place. And we're walking back into the station. And he says, I can smell seal meat. And it's a really, really strong smell. You have a special set of clothes that you only use for sealing.
Mm.
And we're in the bathroom getting, you know, washed up and ready for dinner. And he says, I can smell bloody seal meat. Anyway, we sit down to dinner. And he's really getting quite distressed now because it's a horrible smell of seal meat. And then he blows his nose. And a shard of slowly melting seal meat comes out of his nostril. Really put him off his dinner, poor soul.
There are two directions we can go now with this conversation. Mm-hmm. We can spend some time talking about the science that you did.
Mm-hmm.
Or we could talk a bit more about your development within the management of Bass.
We have
an opportunity to reconvene at another day.
Yeah, that's fine. Well, I don't think the science is all that interesting, actually. I mean, I produce 70 or so papers, and I was more of an enabler than a personal researcher. Some of the things that that I did as a scientist were were very innovative in the sense of starting new experiments that other people then took and used, doing things in the Antarctic that had never been done before.
You built the tallest mast, I believe.
We built the tallest mast, 150-foot mast, and it's on a floating ice shelf and all that sort of stuff.
And you developed the use of cabooses?
Yeah, we did that as well, yes. And that actually, the little village of cabooses that we built at Halley and kept jacked above the surface was really quite important for Bass. I mean, we did it because I'd got this fancy new toy, the Advanced Ionospheric Sounder, the first computer-controlled system, I think, that went to Antarctica, and that was the one that had the huge antennas with the Y-front-shaped antenna hanging between these 150-foot masts and so on. And it was just too valuable to bury under the ice. Mm. And so we had installed it into a custom-built caboose that we could move around and we could take home and all that sort of stuff. But the caboose village really demonstrated the possibilities of having jack facilities at Halley. And it was from there, really, that came the ideas for Halley 5. And it's quite interesting. I'm not quite sure how I got accepted into being part of the team that did a lot of the definition of Halley 5, but I was. It was myself, Big Al, and Paul Whiteman, who were key to where we went when it was clear that Halley 4 was not going to do the job. And I was very keen to try and go on the surface, to have a surface station. And so we did quite a lot of research. For instance, we went up onto the Greenland ice cap and looked at the way the Americans operated their early warning radar sites on jacked structures. They were huge, actually. And we visited the Cold Regions Research Laboratory and looked at their wind tunnel studies on buildings in the Antarctic and so on. And I remember then that I actually made a pitch to what was then the Bass Directors Committee, I suppose, on the possibility of a surface base, whereas Big Al had been tasked to produce an in-house design for another subsurface base, although I think he was always wedded on the idea of a surface base. And it was from that that we built Halley 5. And I think, I'm really proud of Halley 5, although I didn't build it. Yeah. But my part in it I'm really proud of, because that is a station that has been phenomenally successful. In fact, it has been so successful that that has caused its end, because it's lasted much longer than anybody expected and has now reached the stage where it's in danger of becoming an iceberg, which is why, of course, at the beginning of this century, when I'd become deputy director, I led a programme to carry out a risk assessment on future of Halley 5, and from that came the proposal that we would have to rebuild the station, and from that came Halley 6. So in terms of going back to your original question about science, it was more that I really liked coming up with interesting new experiments and making them work in Antarctica, whether it be the Advanced Ionospheric Sounder, which of course Dick Cressman played a really important part in, or whether it was the Over the Horizon radar, the PACE radar, which Mike Pinnock was very important in, or the automatic geophysical observatories that we built. Again, Dick. I mean, I was lucky, and it's often the case, if you look at a successful scientist, next to them is a very, very able technologist or engineer. And I was really lucky in my career to have both Mike Pinnock and Dick Cressman working for me and developing the ideas that I had and doing the practical engineering that was required. And without that, it wouldn't have worked.
Well, let's put the science to one side. I can't promise that they won't send me back and grill you okay. further, but if you want to talk about other things, that's fine by me. Just to go back to Halley 5 again, do you remember the incident or the realisation at Bass headquarters that, in fact, Halley 5 was in a precarious position? Do you remember how that was?
The way that was dealt with was it was Chris Doak, who was a glaciologist in Bass, who started looking at the glaciological behaviour of the Brunt Ice Shelf and realised that, that we might be heading into trouble. And so basically we set up a little group that, that did a risk assessment, a proper risk assessment as far as we could, using whatever data there was available to try and see how the Brunt Ice Shelf behaved and what might be the risks. And although we didn't have enough data to prove it, it appeared to us that the Brunt Ice Shelf had a sort of 60-year cycle of calving and rebuilding. And that goes back partly to the coastline that Shackleton observed when he drifted past locked in the ice in whatever it was, 1915. And so we knew where the most easterly breakback point of the coastline was. And basically our position was that once the station crossed that line, we were heading into risk. But, you know, the risk would get bigger the longer it went on. And the outcome of the study was that 2010 was really the year that we needed to be vacating Halley 5. Now, of course, it's still going strong. It hasn't broken off. But what we did was to set up a program which actively monitored the Brunt Ice Shelf with satellite imagery and GPS strain gauges and so on and so forth. And I assume that that's still running now. I mean, I don't know, but I assume it is, which would give early warning if a break was starting. We always took the view that it wouldn't just suddenly go. There would be some precursor development, widening of cracks at the coast, increase in stress and strain in the ice shelf. Because generally what happened in the past was that chasms would develop. And so we didn't think, you know, you'd wake up one morning and find a crack opening between your legs. But there was an issue that it could happen in the middle of winter. And so there had to be a contingency put in place.
The story I heard was, in fact, that Chris Doakes was clearing his desk and found a map at the bottom of his desk which showed that, in fact, Halley 5 was way beyond.
Well, that may very well be the story. I know that it came to him suddenly, towards the end of his career, and I'm not sure that at that point it was actually way beyond the line, but it was approaching it, certainly was approaching it. Depends exactly where you drew the line. But that was why we instituted what we did, and then others, I think, suggested the idea of the design study, which was the design competition for the base, which was a very interesting process and was very successful except for one factor. And the one factor was that nobody took any notice of the budget. They all claimed they could fit into the budget when it became very apparent very, very quickly that none of them could fit into the budget.
This is Halley 6 we're talking about.
Yeah, Halley 6, yeah. Because the original budget was something like 25 million, and that was one of the fundamentals in the design competition that you fitted into that budget. Nobody did. Although I think still the winning design was the best design and probably the cheapest design. It was nowhere near fitting into that budget. But there we are. What we've ended up with, I think, is a remarkably fine station. I mean, Halley is an incredible place. And I would stand on the... even though I didn't winter there, I spent most of my career one way or another to do with Halley rather than on the peninsula. And to stand on the ice shelf, a floating ice shelf, with no ice, with no rock for hundreds of miles, this ice shelf moving up to 2 metres a day, with the surface building up by a metre a day, and yet to build a station where you could have a shower almost for as long as you wanted, where you had wireless internet, where you had shirt sleeves environment in the laboratories, where it was as advanced a laboratory in some of the sciences it was doing as you would find anywhere in the world, was, I think, remarkable. And the sad thing was that it got so little media coverage because it's so difficult to get there. We did have the one ITV crew come. I think it was in the late 90s, end of the 90s. And that was really good. But we need somehow to be able to get more publicity for that site, because it is, it's Britain at its best, as far as I'm concerned.
Was it also the fact that, again, correct me if I got this wrong, there was a German base also on the ice shelf?
Yeah, Filchner.
Which had, in fact,
yes,
carved.
It carved later. Yeah, actually, it's interesting because the Filchner station, which was a summer-only station down on the Filchner ice shelf, was the basis for the design for Halley 5. It's a company called Christiani and Nielsen, and an engineer called Dieter Enns, who did the design for Halley 5. Yeah, exactly. The Filchner station went away as an ice on an iceberg, and it was at a time when, in Germany, the environmental ministry was under the control of the Greens, and they, the Green Party, and they took a rather extreme view, which required the Germans to remove that station off the ice shelf, off the iceberg, which was a very difficult undertaking. A silly undertaking, really, because it didn't, having a few steel girders on the bottom of the Weddell Sea would create an artificial reef and probably would be beneficial more than anything else. But anyway, that concentrated our minds as well. There's no doubt about that, yeah.
Tell me about how you moved up the... well, first of all, let's get you back to England, because you're still in...
Oh, well, I got back to England in 1969.
With no job to go to.
Sorry?
With no job to go to.
Oh, no job to go to, but an offer of Bass, from Bass, for a few months at the Radio and Space Research Station to sort of tidy up my affairs. But with also the possibility that Piggott had organised for me of doing a PhD at Aberystwyth University. So while I was back at the Radio and Space Research Station, also working in that small group with Roy Piggott, there was a young lady called Helen Mason, who is now my wife, my wife of nearly 40 years, because that's where we met.
She
was a summer student. She was an undergraduate at the time and just about to embark on her third year of university. And she was a local girl, and therefore she got a summer job at Radio and Space Research Station and was working for Piggott. And Piggott, she'd done it the previous year as well, and Piggott had filled her head with various stories about me. So anyway, but that's an aside. So I was back at the Radio Space Research Station, not knowing quite what I was going to do. But it was clear that somewhere in the system, Bass felt that perhaps they needed an in-house ionospheric program. I've been doing some historical research recently for a book I'm writing, and it appears that ionospheric research was more important to Bass than I realised at the time in terms of justifying its existence, but that's another story. And so they offered me a one-year contract to train the staff and so on and so forth and do the resupply and all that thing based at Slough. And that then became an opportunity to do a part-time PhD on the stuff that I'd done in the Antarctic at University College London. And so I existed on what we used to know as Bass contracts in those days, which were not pensionable and various other problems with them. Although for some strange reason, and it's lost in the mists of time, I think Bill Sloman asked me whether I wanted to pay something called FSSU, and I did. Which means I've got a much pension, a better pension now than I would have had otherwise, because I was pensionable from 1969 or something rather than 1974 when I finally got a permanent job with the Natural Environment Research Council. So anyway, I hung on these Bass contracts, basically building a research programme in ionospheric physics, working at the Radio and Space Research Station, because Bass at that time didn't have a home, and I got my PhD in 1974 and was given an appointment with NERC as a higher scientific officer, which I was a bit miffed about because they'd just invented the higher scientific officer grade, which sat between the scientific officer and the senior scientific officer. And otherwise I would have, you know, come in as a senior scientific officer, and a lot of my near peers in Bass were already principals, you know, so I was a bit miffed about that. But anyway, I then went on another tour of Antarctica in 1974-5. And while I was away, a special case was made, because I'd just got my PhD, that I should be given immediate promotion, which was successful. And so I suddenly found myself as an SSO in 1975. And then, of course, we were looking forward to the move of Bass to Cambridge, which took place in 1976. And although the original design had not included any space for me and mine, because we, you know, we sort of didn't really exist to start with, we were given good facilities, and we did move to Cambridge, where I continued building this ionospheric research program. And by that time, Roy Piggott, who had retired from the Radiant Space Research Station, had taken the job of being the first head of this new division of atmospheric sciences for Bass. So I was working directly for him in Cambridge. And I, you know, in the 70s, I was developing some of these programs, including this digital sounder and publishing papers. I suppose I was a moderately successful scientist. I wasn't going to get an FRS or a Nobel Prize or anything, partly because I wasn't that driven by it. I was more interested in other things.
Such as?
Well, I was much more interested in coming up with an interesting experiment,
right,
and then having the logistics and technical job of making it work in Antarctica.
So you became an initiator rather than...
Yeah, an enabler is the word, yeah, I like to use. That I think, is my scientific achievement, has been as an enabler of science in Antarctica. First of all, in my own field, but subsequently when I became deputy director in a much broader
field. What was happening to Bass generally around that time? Because it was the move to Cambridge had other side effects, didn't it, of reorganisation?
Well, it was being reorganised and brought together, and we had the three science divisions formed, the Earth Sciences, Life Sciences and Atmospheric Sciences division, and formal division heads, and they were starting to get a career structure. But of course Bass was also under a lot of pressure financially through the late 70s, and we, you know, we were having to look to make very serious financial retrenchments. And in that regard, it was really quite remarkable that I got the money that I did, which was a very large sum of money for the time, to develop this digital sounder. Somebody had obviously decided to, and I think it was Dick Laws, actually, who decided he was going
to
do it, and he was going to back me and go with me.
How did you rate Dick?
Oh, Dick, I think Dick was an outstanding director. He was the guy that took Bass and made it into a scientific organisation, without doubt. He was an interesting chap. If he respected you, then he would really go for you, you know, and help you. If you fell on the bad side of him, there was no recovery. It was the icy eyeballs or the smiling eyes with Dick, and if you got icy eyeballs, I think that was it, really. That's my personal appreciation, but I had an awful lot of time for Dick, still do. He was very important to my career, along with Sir Vivian and Bill Sloman and Roy. I think he was an outstanding, probably the outstanding director of Bass, actually.
Were you watching managerial technique, bearing in mind that you had been surprisingly promoted to base commander? Was management in your nostrils? And were you,
well, I think management and leadership was becoming so, and you know, I was managing an ever increasing number of people, managing their careers and managing a science program and trying to be innovative and enjoying it, actually. And I did find much more enjoyment as I move further up the tree, in being involved in the big decisions and being able to range widely across the portfolio of Bass, particularly when I got up into the into the top shop, as it were.
What possessed you to apply for deputy director?
Well, I applied for the deputy director's job twice, actually.
Oh, I know. First time round. When was that?
First time round was in 1985, when David Drury left. I suppose it was 1984 when David Drury left. And I was bumped up to be acting deputy director with Barry Hayward. And it was a natural thing to go for it. I followed my maxim, you kick yourself if you don't do it, so do it. As same as I did much younger when I applied for the division head post and didn't get that either. I have to be careful what I say here, because the individual who got the division head job in 1980, I would have to say I did not see eye to eye with. And the individual who got the deputy director's job in 1995, I would have to say I did not see eye to eye with either.
85, you mean?
Well, no, 95, but we got the deputy director's job in 95. I didn't see eye to eye with either. I didn't think either of them were appropriate for the job, but I have to be careful because, of course, I was also applying for the job. But anyway, in 1995, I didn't get the job. And I was really not terribly happy about that, because I felt I was ready to move on to broader things. But I went back to being the head of division, and we did some really interesting things in that division then. I think, actually, subsequently, I think it was clear that I had been managing my division pretty well compared with how some of the others were being managed. But I'm not, again, it's not something I can really talk about, because it involves naming names and so on. I'm not going to do that. But when Barry crocked himself and Dougal stepped up to being acting director, then I stepped up to being acting deputy director. And suffice it to say that I was invited to apply for the job of director. I never actually applied again for the job of deputy director. I was invited to apply for the job of director by the then chief executive of NERC. But I was told that I wouldn't get the job unless there was no acceptable external candidate.
Right. Okay. So their agenda was to bring somebody in from the outside?
Their agenda was to bring somebody in from the outside, but to have a backstop.
If it didn't happen.
That they felt they could give the job to.
Was there any sense of Bass having trod water for the last couple of years?
It was a very bad period of Bass's history. We had this problem and this advantage known as the ring fence, where our funding was ring fenced, and therefore we felt that we could sit behind our silo and do our thing. But we were inside a research council who didn't understand our dual mission and who was forever sniping, from their point of view, quite reasonably at the ring fence. It was a bad period, and nobody comes out of it with any credit, really, I don't think, either us in Bass or the senior management and the middle management of NERC. Mm. It really was a poor period for Bass, that last 5 years at the end of the century. So we were doing good science, some really good science, but the politics was completely wrong and the relationships were completely wrong, and they were really only heading in one direction. Which is why I think, quite reasonably, they wanted an external candidate, but also why they wanted somebody they could give the job to if necessary. So, as it turned out, I passed the board. They told me I'd passed the board, but Chris Rapley was given the job. Now, he joined Bass while I was actually down in the Antarctic. And you'd need to talk to him, and you probably have done, about the circumstances of that winter. But he had the acting director, who substantively was the deputy director, and he had me. And I think it probably must have been in the first week. I'm not party to what discussions took place between him and the chief executive of NERC or whatever. But I was flying in a Twin Otter from Halley to Rotherham. And a lovely day, actually. Beautiful, beautiful mountain views as we were flying over the peninsula. Just went on forever. And on the radio came a message that as soon as I landed, I needed to get on the sat phone and talk to the new director. So I landed, got on the sat phone and talked to the new director. And he said, I'd like you to be deputy director. So I never actually applied the second time. I was given the job.
Had you met Chris Rapley?
No.
Were you surprised, suspicious,
incredulous? No. I knew that something had got to happen. I was definitely not feeling happy about going back to being just a division head, because my horizons had expanded very significantly by then. I didn't know that what happened would happen, but I knew that something had got to happen. And so I wasn't actually that surprised. It was a very, very positive thing. I was really pleased. And I was very heartened by the attitude on base as well. They all seemed to be really pleased about it. Whether they stayed pleased is another matter, and you may have information from other people about that. But I think they did, actually. But it was a very interesting decision, and one that showed Chris to be a very decisive chap, and I would say he is a very decisive chap.
It was a kind of new broom, wasn't it?
Well, it was a new broom, but it was also pointed out to me very shortly afterwards that as far as the chief executive of NERC was concerned, he'd got the dream team, because he had the new broom and he had somebody who had the respect of the staff and the experience. And I think, actually, that's how it worked out. I think that Chris and I, and Chris obviously is the leader, but Chris and I turned that organisation around and turned it into what it was subsequently referred to as a jewel in the crown of Bass's of Britain's science.
Can you tell me a bit about the conversations you had with Chris when you got back, which led to this turnaround?
Well, they were very sensitive in some ways, because of course we were looking at the whole of how Bass ran, and we knew it got to be changed very, very significantly.
He said he needed to address the structure of the science.
Yes, exactly, he did. And we did that together, I believe. Coming up, you know, Chris is a very, very able chap, both as a scientist, but also as a science manager. He's unusual in that regard. Mostly when you get senior scientists, they're good at the science, but they're rather dismissive of management. Chris was very different. He recognised and understood the importance of science management and science leadership in an organisation like that, which was really important. He wasn't well liked by the staff. Perhaps was understandable, and perhaps I was able to bask a bit in that regard. But I took the view then, and I believe I held to it, that the only way that it could work was that any criticism I had, I said directly to Chris, and outside we didn't present the slightest idea of a difference between us.
So it wasn't good cop, bad cop?
Well, we may have played that at times as well, but not in terms of presentation to the staff. I believe that presentationally, Chris and I made certain that we were a united front as far as the staff were concerned. And any differences we had, we kept between us. And, you know, sometimes he would take what I said on board and sometimes he wouldn't. But that's the nature of the game. So, no, we did some fairly intensive thinking and discussing about how we should take things forward and how we would develop a management team that worked cohesively, that didn't leak, that didn't brief against each other and stuff like that, which was going on at the time. And I think we were remarkably successful in that.
Chris brought in some other characters into fairly high positions as well, John Pye in particular.
Well, Chris and I together interviewed and selected John Pye. And again, JP, as he likes to be known, wasn't best liked by people. But I think he was an extremely important positive force in Bass. He came in with a very clear vision of how an organisation should be run and how it's effectively run and how it's effectively managed. And he convinced us, and he did it. And I think you will find, whether it still is the case, it's 6 years nearly since I was involved. But I think our management system at the time that I retired and then Chris retired was really, really good. It actually worked. We had a Bass board that worked as a board, that had information provided to it that it needed to have to make decisions in a sensible way. And a lot of that was JP's doing. But like everybody, JP had his bad sides as well as his good sides.
So what was that structure then? Was it a round table, or was it a prime minister and a cabinet? How would you describe that structure?
I would describe it as a prime minister and a cabinet. But the way that we made a long-term strategy, we instituted these away days, away weekends or whatever, first of all with a professional facilitator to help build the team. But once the team had been built, and it was built, then they were really effective ways at looking at the broader strategy and the longer-term things that we needed to look at. And that meant that the Bass board meetings were about, you know, now, running the organisation now, what needed to be dealt with now. And they were very, very slick and effective meetings compared with some that I'd attended in earlier years, which would just drone on and on and on. And so I think we built a team that worked. And it was a joy to be part of it, actually.
One of the building blocks of that team was a chap called, I think, Barry Smith, is that right?
Oh, yeah. Bringing in an external member of the board. And that was really important, actually, because he had an insight. You know, he came in without knowing anything at all about Bass. But he had a real insight on how certainly commercial organisations work. And so he could cut through a discussion like a knife through butter. And that was really important. I think bringing in the external board member, and I think they now have two, as far as I remember, was a very useful part of the process. That was actually an idea that Chris was really responsible for.
What was the mood then? Were you firefighting? Were you
creating
the Roman Empire?
What were you? Well, to start with, we had to reestablish a reputation for Bass. And I think we did that in the first couple of years.
You mean the scientific reputation?
Well, a reputation for really excellent science, but as a cooperative organisation, an organisation people wanted to work with, work at, and so on, and try and change the perception, certainly amongst NERC in Swindon, of Bass.
Was that a driving factor? Was the fact that Bass was regarded rather slightly by NERC at that time?
Well,
were you trying to please the headmaster?
No, we weren't trying to please the headmaster. We were trying to make certain that we were robust and unimpeachable, and that one of the main things we wanted to do was to make Bass science stand on its merit and not stand on or behind a ring fence. We wanted bass science to be seen to be world-class science as well as being world-class science. And I think that was the primary driver for both of us. Certainly, I think that was the primary driver for Chris. He wanted the organisation to be doing world-class science and to be seen to be doing it.
Do you have any regrets about the casualties of that process? People like that who fell from grace, or fell from, not grace, that's not true, fell from positions of authority.
That's a difficult question to answer.
I mean, I have a lot of time. You do have a bit of...
I have a lot of time for... Because, of course, he goes back a long time in Bass. But didn't find it easy to adapt to the modern style of management or the need to really be able to justify our science on a world stage, I think. And I think in the end, the approach that we adopted was probably the best one for both of both Bass and him.
Which was?
Well, that he basically was moved aside and given other duties towards the end of his career.
I don't really want to talk about individuals. I'm just thinking about the journey. There was a clear out of certain.
Well, yeah, there was people. A clear out, and that one is always conscious that, you know, you're dealing with people's aspirations, their careers, their lives.
Long-term employees.
Well, had been on a 5-year contract, and that just wasn't renewed. Was basically what happened. And I'm not going to say any more about that.
Okay, no, I understand.
There were real issues that individuals weren't able to adapt. Some were and some weren't. Some embraced the approach we were adopting. And, for instance, David Walton in particular, I think. He's a survivor, is David. he embraced what was going on. But others didn't find it so easy to do. So Chris, there were casualties, yeah.
Chris, I interviewed him only yesterday, which is why it's all fresh in my mind.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Talks about going into the canteen and taking out the tables and replacing them with round tables. So the scientists couldn't sit where they've always sat for the last 30 years.
Yeah, it was very... Well, that may be true. We did do some reorganisation in the canteen, but it was only partially successful. They still managed to get their little enclaves. And I used to make a habit. Chris wasn't actually that keen on going into the coffee room and sitting with people. I found he didn't find that... I think he didn't find it as easy as he might have done. Whereas I saw that as a very important part of my role, was to move around the coffee room and mixing with the different groups and just talking with them.
So was there a sense of kind of white heat about all this? Was Bass suddenly going places?
Yes, and we did go places. And we were assisted as well by the new chief executive of NERC, Sir John Lawton. John is a very able chap, and unlike any other chief executive of NERC, he recognised, first of all, that he ran NERC and that everybody were his employees. Most of them didn't even see it that way. But he also recognised the right way to run a corporate structure like that, basically the issue of subsidiarity, only taking the decisions at the centre that needed to be taken at the centre, and bringing the directors of the NERC institutes into the centre to be part of the management team. And so he was very important in creating a new relationship between Bass senior management and NERC senior management. Unfortunately, it never really filtered down into NERC middle management. But at the senior management level, we had a very much better working relationship with NERC during the time that John Lawton was chief executive.
One of your tasks was to try and upgrade the health and safety procedures for Bass, which I would imagine was quite a challenge, wasn't it?
I found it a fascinating and very interesting challenge because it was a whole new area for me, and certainly getting involved in it at a management level. But I really enjoyed it, and I think we put in procedures in place which have stood the test of time, and I think also without unnecessarily restricting people, allowing people still to have the fun in the Antarctic, that is why people go. We put in a regime which meant we didn't kill anybody.
Can you give examples? Of the changes you made.
Oh, well, risk assessment that works. Being a learning organisation, but not being a blame culture. Particularly learning from our mistakes, so the accident, incident, near miss reporting system that we put in place, I think was as successful as any that have ever been anywhere, and did make us a learning organisation. But I think it was, I kicked off very early to say that this was a no blame accident, incident, near miss reporting centre. We weren't going to blame people if they came forward and reported their mistakes. I think it took a while for people to recognise that that was true. But also, it was the staff who ultimately said, well, look, this can't be a no-blame culture completely. And that's true if you have somebody who's culpably negligent or criminally negligent, then, of course, you can't have a no-blame system. But if somebody errs, but not intentionally, then no-blame should accrue to them. And that meant that we started hearing about things, both serious and funny, that we wouldn't have otherwise heard about. I mean, the funniest...
Oh, right. So you were removing the excuse for not telling you, basically.
Yes.
Yes.
And that made us into a learning organisation. And so the idea was that you carry out risk assessment, you do accident, incident, near miss reporting, you do audits of safety, you do training... and you make certain that any serious instance you have, you properly investigate and learn the lessons. That was really what I tried to institute as a management system.
I'm not sure of my chronology, so I apologise if I got this wrong, but were you there when Kirsty was...
Yes, I was... Kirsty Brown. Yes, it was on my watch. And I was the one that had to drive down and tell her parents.
What can you tell me about that?
Well, that process? Again, that was a... it was a tragedy. It may sound funny to say this, but we were very lucky in Kirsty's parents. But
how do you mean?
Well, I'll come on to that in a minute. Mm. It was an evening about 10:30. I was just going up to bed here when the phone rang.
Sunday evening, I think, wasn't it?
Yes, the phone rang, and it was John Hall.
John
Hall. Reporting that we'd had a fatality, and so we immediately instituted our instant response team at Bass. Mm-hmm. And again, that was part of JP's doing, as well as John's and others, that we had a very effective response. It didn't have a great big manual, a foot thick, in the instant that somebody gets eaten by a leopard seal, do this, or a plane crashes, do that. It was more built on having the right people present and being able to pull the right people in and having the right procedures for expanding the need. And so we pulled the team in, which included, right from the beginning, Linda Kappa for media, JP, myself, John Hall, and one or two others, and started working on the problem straight away. We had two teams. We had the instant response team and a second team, which was the sort of technical team that would go away and think about, well, how do you do things? What needs doing? What's the long-term consequence of this, that, or the other?
So everybody was driving to Cambridge, were they? They were all driving to Bass?
Yeah, people came into Bass.
On Sunday night.
And I can't remember exactly. No, okay. It's probably in my diary. But, yeah. But we all started work. And then the first obvious question was, how do we tell the parents? Mm.
Did you volunteer?
Well, it was just obviously it was going to be me. I was sort of chairing the meeting. I don't know whether there was a positive decision issue, but it seemed to be the right person to do it. But the question is, you know, first of all, we went through the process. Should we pick up the phone and call them, you know, 10:30 at night? Should we get the police to go round? No, none of that. We would arrange that we would be there early enough in the morning that if they were going out, they would still be there before, you know, by the time we got there, but not too early to make it a drama. And so we had a company that provided limousines for us when we needed them, and we laid that on. And myself and the then head of HR, Fiona Brazil, headed down together on that. But here was where JP became very important, because he had experience of handling this in the military. And he said, well, look, whoever goes there and gives the news is the bad guy in their eyes from there on. So what you need is a team of white hats coming down behind, if they want them. And so we arranged that an hour behind us would be Kirsty's manager at Bass, coming down, I think, with somebody else, but I can't remember who now. So that if the Brown family wanted to have somebody they could talk to, these people could then be their friends.
Mm.
And that's a really important thing, and something which perhaps isn't obvious unless you've been through it often. So we arrived down there. Fiona was brilliant because, you know, this was not an easy thing to do.
And you'd had little sleep.
And I'd had no sleep, really, a couple of hours. I managed to get home here for an hour or two, I think, because we had to leave, you know, sort of 4:30 in the morning or something. And so on the way down, we talked through what we were going to do, and Fiona was a very good steadying influence for me, actually, so that I, you know, I knew that I'd got somebody who I could really have in support when I got there. And we broke the news to them. They took it extremely well.
Are you willing to talk a bit about that?
Well, the Brown family are a very close-knit family, I think. But they are also a family that is used to doing activities that are a little bit more out of the way, a little bit more risky. And they had a very clear-eyed, practical view of it. And the one thing that they didn't do ever, as far as I know, certainly not with us, was to consider the issue of who to blame.
Mm.
Now, they accepted the offer of the second team. And then what we did was to make, I think it was Dave Barnes in Bass who was the person, a bit of a Sky Ranger up until that time, but he really performed this very, very well. He then became their friend and became involved in the response team and was their liaison into this response team. So he could tell them what was going on, what we were doing and how we were doing it. And they could feed their feelings into that response system, which I think worked really well, actually. And I think they were appreciative of that anyway. So then we had to decide, all right, well, there was nothing we could do about Kirsty because she was dead. But we had to do something about the base. And we quickly decided that we would attempt to get in there because we felt that leaving Kirsty's body on the base for a winter or for the rest of the winter and leaving the team there without any support, you know, back in my year, my era, that's what would have happened and did happen. But that wasn't appropriate anymore if the capability existed to be able to get in there. So we positioned two Twin Otters and the Dash 7 down to Falklands. The Twin Otters were on standby as the search and rescue for the Dash.
Yeah.
Basically.
You have to think of these things, don't you?
Yes, indeed. Well, because it was something we'd never attempted before, a winter flight.
Was there any... Sorry, around the board table, was there some debate about whether to do this or not?
Yes. We carried out a risk assessment on it. But decided that we should do it. So myself and, oh, goodness me, I'm bad on names now.
John, we can look this up later.
Laura Burrows, I think, was her name at the time. She may not be Burrows anymore, but she was one of Fiona's people. Again, a very level-headed and capable young lady came with me, and we went down to the Falkland Islands to go on the flight.
You went?
Yes.
And Chris Rapley as well?
No.
No,
it was decided that I should go. There was some suggestion that was the base's choice, but I don't know to what extent that was true. But
you were more familiar with the Antarctic than he was.
Well, than Chris or JP. You know, I would be more likely to be empathetic with them on base, and for that matter, not be quite so overawed by suddenly turning up in the middle of winter in the Antarctic, because, you know, it wasn't something unfamiliar to me. So we positioned the aircraft to Stanley, and then we had to wait for weather. We were taking with us a policeman and the coroner down as well, and a coffin, of course, to bring her back. And we got this weather window. We had stripped the weight of the aeroplane down and what we were carrying down to as minimum as we could, because I don't know whether you know, but the Dash 7 in normal operations doesn't quite have the range to get to Rotherham and back without needing to refuel. But we got to the stage where the aeroplane could get to Rotherham and back, and we thought we could probably make one missed approach at Rotherham and still get back.
So it was that critical?
Yeah. So, of course, at the point of no return, basically, we had to decide whether we were going on or not. And the weather reports were reasonably good as we were heading down. But as we got closer, it started to snow at Rotherham. And it was quite interesting. I was sitting up in the jump seat between the two pilots, and Ant was the co-pilot, and I'm having trouble with names, but it'll come back to me, the other guy sitting in the other seat. But anyway, a couple of very experienced BAS pilots. And as we were flying down, of course, we were above the cloud, and you could see Alexander Island lit up in sunshine, but Rotherham is snowing. So Ant calls them up and says, can you see Alligator Ridge? I see Alligator Ridge or Crocodile Ridge or something like that. It's across the runway from the station. And they say yes. He said, we'll make an approach. What I want you to do is to line vehicles up at the end of the runway, which is where the jetty was, the southern end. And when I tell you, with their lights on, when I tell you light flares. Now, the aircraft had an operating limit. Well, the BAS operating procedures were that if you couldn't see the threshold of the runway at 1 nautical mile on the distance measurement, the DME, then you overshoot. So we're coming down through the snow, and I'm sitting there watching the DME ticking back, 1.2 nautical miles, 1.1 nautical mile. Nothing, just bloody fog and snow in front of us. And just as the pilot's hands were going for the throttles to go for the go-round, we see the flares. Just as we hit 1 nautical mile, so we go for the landing. And, of course, by then, the runway that they'd very carefully cleared of snow was not clear of snow. But we landed. It's my memory that when the snow settled, we weren't actually pointing up and down the runway. But, you know, we were in. We then, Laura and I, spent some time talking to people. I took the doctor for a walk around the station, you know, outside, for a quiet word with her, to give her a chance to drain down a bit. And I addressed the whole station in the evening, gave them a chance to talk about things, talk about Kirsty, talk about whatever they wanted to talk about, really. We woke up the following morning, it was blowing a hoolie, So we didn't think we were going to be able to get out that day. But then the weather cleared later in the morning. And so we had a sort of ceremony of, you know, in which we took Kirsty in the coffin to the aeroplane. And then we flew home.
What was it like at the base? These were the winterers, weren't they?
I think they were calm. They were obviously being greatly affected by what had happened, because it was a very nasty incident. Mm. And they had tried very hard to recover her and save her, and she was much liked on base. But they were calm, and I think they were very appreciative of the fact that Bass had gone to the effort to get me in there and Laura in there, and to, you know, go about the business of getting Kirsty back to her family so they could bury her. But it was a very difficult time for everybody, I think. But again, I believe that Bass handled it as well as they could, as well as we could. And the family were outstanding. What they did was, rather than try and start sticking blame on anybody, was to establish a trust fund in Kirsty's name, which was then used by Bass to carry out a research study on human impacts, human interactions with leopard seals, as part of our risk assessment before we restarted the programme of diving at Rotherham. And so there was a real sense in which something good had come out of it and something lasting had come out of it.
You're a secondary modern boy who got a degree in physics, who is suddenly faced with a limousine drive to go down to break some news.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not what you'd expect when you were passing your GCSEs and your...
No. That's why I think I would have to say, as I said right at the beginning of this evening, that my experience of going to the Antarctic in 1966 completely changed my perception of me and the path of my life, without doubt, and led me into doing some pretty harrowing things, to being in situations where I could have been killed, to doing some fantastic things and some really enjoyable things, and to have had a career that, you know, I really have to be really grateful for. It's been an incredible career. And I can honestly say, even though it's had its frustrations and its ups and downs and in problems, you know, when I didn't get promoted and I wanted to be, I haven't had a job for a living. I've had a tremendous amount of fun for a living, really. And a very rewarding one as well, because I think Bass is in a much stronger position now, even though, again, it's suffering under the hand of rather heavy-handed NERC and also the funding problems. It's in a very, very strong position to be able to weather that. It's a very professional organisation, which has enormous amount of respect worldwide. And I'm proud of my part in that, I think.
I appreciate your frankness. Thank you.